Yes. One of my favorite verses in Scripture is in Exodus 4, when Moses has been whining about why he can't do anything, and God, who never gets frustrated, and I'm glad for his eternal patience, does say to Moses, "What do you have in your hand?" And Moses has a rod, and God has him throw it down on the ground, and of course it becomes a serpent, and it scares the daylights out of Moses. But it serves a good purpose for then and forever after. As we know, the Hippocratic Oath is that rod on the serpent on the staff. So that's an example of how someone used something that was in his hand for good purposes. I think too, and I brought it and I left it in my purse. Who likes peanut butter? Peanut butter is one of my favorite foods, and I'm so thankful to George Washington Carver for using his God-given knowledge of the peanut and the soybean and other natural things to create something that is now extraordinarily useful for us worldwide and has been of such benefit. Well, I think that we see this in art as well. Artists have things in their hands that can be used for good purposes. What do you have in your hand? Maybe after this lecture tonight, you'll think more critically about what you have in your hand and how it can be used to do great things. One thing I'd like to point out about the history of art is that paint has been developed over time. And we have paints now that people didn't have prior to the Renaissance. We use art forms now that were not used earlier. For example, the Greeks had encaustic painting, which was an early form of enamel, where they would heat stuff on wood panels and then press it with a hot iron, and it would look like enamel. We'll see some of that tonight. There was also water and egg tempera that was used quite a bit. And that was used up through the Renaissance, quite realistically, in a lot of pieces. But then we also have we have oils that were used that really made art come alive. And the art that we see, the art that's so memorable today, is makes use of those modern forms of art media. Also tonight you'll see some sculptures, some stained glass, pottery. This morning I saw these textiles on the wall. That's a form of art that historically has been very popular. And of course different forms of architecture are all used to make use of what we have in our hand and display the power and glory of God. So we want to look at that idea, and I want you to think about the hand of the Madonna and the child and art. You may be surprised that this first image I have here is certainly not of the Madonna and child. It may be a picture of you and your child, or you and your mother, or your wife and son, or some friends of yours. We're drawn to this image for some reason. And I wonder why we tend to be drawn to this kind of an image, the image of the mother and child. Why might images of Mary and Jesus be so important to us and to the artists who created these images? So we want to look at this one as a start. What are we drawn to? What do we like about this? What's important here? Look at the elements in this picture. We see the eyes. The eyes that are glowing and gleaming and excited, looking out to the camera or out. And the mother's looking right at the child. She's not concerned about the person taking the picture. They're very close. There's the hand of the little boy. He's smiling. We're really drawn to this picture. We want to know this mother and this child. It makes us feel certain ways. I think art attempts to physically capture what C.S. Lewis called joy. When I look at this picture, that's what I think of, joy. Now, Lewis couldn't pigeonhole joy, and neither can I. But his concept of joy was seeing beyond the ordinary, farther up and further in, as he says in The Last Battle, a journey to the sublime. And most artists run on the tailwinds of this kind of an idea. We feel it in the picture. We feel the wonderful. And I hope you'll be able to capture that same feeling of wonder and the sublime in the other images that we look at. Would you do the next slide? Also in reference to C.S. Lewis, you know, his professor Kirk was fond of saying, it's all in Plato. In Plato's allegory of the cave, images of ideals are portrayed within a cave to residents who are confined in that cave. They can't see the outside. All they can see are the images reflected on the back wall. In a sense, they saw through a glass darkly. We know we do that. Those residents in the cave would interpret those ideas that they saw differently based on their positions and their perspectives and their attitudes. That's what we do in our lives when we look at our day-to-day things, and in art when we look at what other people have created. Well, this slide is a modern interpretation of Plato's cave. We see a person staring at a laptop image of the world outside her view. It's a man-made image. It's a contrivance. It plays out an idea, as you can see on this. It symbolizes or puts value on an ideal. And of course, we're doing the same thing because we're using a laptop to see images that are portrayed on a screen. So tonight, we want to look at images of mother and child that could be used to further our imagination, to symbolize, to represent or play out, or to demonstrate value, or to portray. So the third slide shows some Byzantine image icons. And we'll go from early to more the present with this slideshow. I should point out that early Christian icons were used to share visual images, and they were aids for worship. In Byzantine theology, just contemplating the icon allowed the viewer a more direct communication with the sacred figure that was represented. Not quite in the Presbyterian tradition, but it was very important in that tradition, in that theology. Though icons, really through the icons, an individual's prayers were addressed directly to that petitioned saint. They're typically small scale. They could be as small as a locket with two hinges that would open up to be a triptych, and then the images often of Jesus, Mary, Joseph, or one of the saints would be depicted in there. They are symbols that represent an ideal. They don't appear natural or realistic to us. This does not look like Mary and Jesus, what our image of Mary and Jesus is. But we're still attracted to these, because when you look at art, you usually are attracted to it aesthetically first, and then symbolically. That's kind of the way we're made up. We can say, I know what I like, but then we have to figure out why we like what we see. We have to interpret it and understand it. So we look beyond what we see and we look for the meaning, similar to Plato's cave. Like I said, icons could be as small as a piece of jewelry, but they could also fill entire walls. And Byzantine art, while it mainly focused on these big representations of Mary, Joseph, and Jesus, or one of the other saints, they were, when they showed these figures, they were larger than anybody else. They were not just huge pieces on a wall, but if there were other figures, they were very tiny next to Mary, Joseph, and Jesus. This showed the power of the saint. Okay? It showed the power of the Creator. A large image, when we walk into a big room, we're full of awe. Okay? We look at Notre Dame. We look at huge statues, huge images, and those exert some kind of power over us. We feel that they have a power that we don't have. And that was the plan with Byzantine art and a lot of art through the centuries, that art wanted to have some kind of, or the creators of the art, or the those who ordered the art to be created, would use those to show the power over us. So two of these images, this one and this one, are mosaics, and mosaics were popular in Byzantine art. That was, everybody's familiar with little tiny mosaic tiles. If you go to the Art Institute, they have a wonderful exhibit right now of Byzantine art that has beautiful pieces that are all mosaic tile, and these are just two images. The first one, this is called Our Lady of 100 Gates. When the Emperor Constantine's mother, Helena, went to the Holy Land, she had some dreams that she was going to find the cross. So she took a ship, which you see here, and she went off to the Holy Land looking for the cross of Christ. And she figured she found it, so she brought it back. But while she was on board the ship, she also dreamt that that she would find images of, or she would find these images of Mary and Jesus as well. She built a temple to Mary, not to Jesus. She built a temple. It's called the Temple to the Mother of God. And the mosaic tiles in that temple represent that. You'll notice, too, in here, the red color, the gold around here. Color was really popular in Byzantine art and in most art. It represented, it symbolized different things. Gold symbolized heaven. Red symbolized divine life. Blue was human life. White was purity or transfiguration. You'll also often see Jesus in art wearing a red undergarment with a blue outer garment, okay? Which, of course, the divine taking on the form of man. And you'll see Mary wearing red over blue, okay? Not always, but often that's the way it is. You'll also see Greek letters in that second image. In many of the iconic images like this, it identifies Jesus as I am who I am, and Mary as Holy Mary or Mother of God. Byzantine art never shows Mary without Jesus. The third image is one of the most famous Byzantine icons. It's called the Virgin of Hodegetria. Hopefully I pronounced that right. It's the kind of image that was used throughout art, throughout history, to represent Mary and Jesus. So it's the image that we kind of expect of Mary and Jesus. Jesus looks like a miniature adult here, and Mary cradles him in her left arm, and she points to him with her right hand, signifying that he is the way. Okay? Hodegetria means the way shower, or the one who shows the way. So she's pointing to him as the way. Jesus' hand in this image, his right hand, is raised in blessing to the viewer. This is also very, very common, and we'll see this in other forms later on. The index and the middle finger in this image are joined. So the index and the middle finger are joined like that, and that refers to the two natures of Christ. And the thumb locks over the other fingers to signify the Trinity. So when you look at art, when you look at Jesus or Mary, you'll often see that. And when you see people giving a blessing, often they give the blessing with their hand formed that way. Icons tend to be a subject of legend, and you know about the iconoclasm later on, but in the next slide we'll look at a couple icons from the Russian Orthodox Church tradition. You want to go ahead and do the next one? This first one is called the Black Madonna. According to legend, Luke had Mary and Jesus sit down, and he painted a picture of them. And this is it. And while he was painting, Mary was talking to him about things that happened. Okay. This icon is in Poland, and it's in a church that was invaded in the 1400s by a looter who saw the image, and he struck it twice with his sword. And the third time he struck it, he fell down and died. If you are in front of this icon, you can actually see the sword marks in it. People travel to this icon and other icons expecting miracles, and there have been a number of miracles that have been attributed to this icon. It's called the Black Madonna simply because there's soot from all the candles that are in front of it. The second image is the image of the inexhaustible cup. Here's Mary and Jesus again. This is from the 19th century, so we've just jumped 500 years between the two images. But this is from the 19th century, and the story behind this is there was a man who was an alcoholic, and he had a number of dreams that he needed to go to a particular convent about 60 miles outside of Moscow. And when he got to the convent, he was to ask for prayers to be said in front of this particular icon. And so he got there. And he knocked on the door and he said, "I'm looking for this particular image and you need to pray for me." And they said, "We don't have that image here." And he said, "Yes, you do. I had dreams that told me to come here." And so they looked all over the place and they found this image stuck away in a little hole in the wall. And so they did, and he never had another drink. Okay. We'll move on to the next one. And what I'd like you to think about from these past two slides and then the two slides that we're seeing ahead, look for something that's the same in these past two slides and the two that are coming up. So we look at this. This is the Giro crucifix. It's in Cologne, Germany. And it's a wooden crucifix, and it's at the top of the altar, and right this area, there's a space back there for the bread, for the host. And so whenever communion was done, they would put a piece of the host back there. This is just Jesus, not Mary, but I wanted to get these kinds of things in. The wooden carving at the top is of Mary and Jesus. It's broken. Originally, Jesus was holding a copy of the scriptures. But this is in France, and it's from the 12th century. So we've moved forward just, we came back from the Russian icon, but we're moving forward really historically. This type of sculpture, this wooden sculpture, is this kind of setting of Mary and Jesus is known as the Throne of Wisdom. It looks simple, but it's full of some rather complex theology. Here, Mary serves as Christ's throne. And like King David and King Solomon, Christ possesses great wisdom and justice. So there would have been a copy of the scriptures in front of that. This middle image is a carving that is the capital piece that is in the choir loft of another cathedral in France. And it was produced around 1100. Here we see Mary and Jesus being led on a donkey by Joseph, and they're returning from Egypt. We'll see this again in another image. And then we have this one. This is a rather famous one. It's gold. It's on a wood panel. It's gold and it's encaustic with gold paint over it. And here we see that Mary is looking out at us now. Jesus is still holding his hand up in blessing. All the angels are around him. But throughout art history, Mary would be increasingly portrayed as a very nurturing person. And revered there. She was the intercessor. She was full of mercy. Jesus is seated on her lap, and everybody is looking out at the audience, which was a real change that was coming up historically. The next slide. Remember, previously we had that that carved capital from the choir loft, and Mary and Jesus and Joseph returning from Egypt. Well, this is another image, stained glass, and this is a story of legend too. They're returning from Egypt. Mary's hungry, and so Jesus reached up to a tree and had the branch come. He's not tall enough to get the branch to come down, but he commanded the branch to come down, and it had dates on it so Mary could eat. This is from the 12th century. And this, too, is in Paris. This is stained glass, and I think it's interesting to note that stained glass made back then is not that dissimilar to the way it's made now. It's very dangerous. People died who were stained glass workers because of the lead that was involved, breathing in the lead, but sand and ash were burned, and then they were stained with metal oxides to get the different colors. They were blown and flattened into sheets, and then they were put on a cartoon and very carefully cut, and then put in lead framework or iron framework. But the colors you see are really painted on. So the faces are painted. It's not just a part of the glass. So if you look at old stained glass, even around here in a lot of stained glass in very old churches, you'll see it's actually painted as well as stained. The same church that the stained glass in, we see this gold statue of Jesus and Mary, and look at how realistic and natural they look compared to the iconic images in the earlier slides. And being a gold worker was a lot healthier than being a stained glass worker. Yeah.
Nancy, looks like a blue-stemmed plant behind the neck of the dog.
It's another plant. Yeah, it doesn't. Getting away from the extreme symbolism of the earlier, this is just for art's sake, kind of. And then the piece below, the final image, that's a famous part of a marble baptistry that Nicola Pissarro carved. He was an artist of the Middle Ages who really looked back to Roman art, and he wanted to create very natural, normal-looking images. And really, we have Pissarro to thank. Pisano, I'm thinking Pissarro, the Impressionist. Pisano is the one who did this. And we really have him to thank for the natural images that we see later. I think that would be a good subject for research, because in the Renaissance, people kind of disregarded the medieval art and the medieval writing and all of that, and they look back to the more ancient, and you see, this is an example of someone looking back to the Roman art to try to make it more natural. But anyway, what do you think those four slides all have in common? Did anybody see any one thing that seem to be the same? I see halos. Everybody's got a halo. We don't see halos anymore, really. But everybody back then painted, drew, sculpted, whatever they did it with halos. The thing is, halos aren't exclusive to Christian art. We think halos mean, like God. But halos didn't necessarily mean God back in time, pre-Christian times. So we'll look at the next slide, and we'll look at some halos in pre-Christian art. Here's some unusual things. This is the Egyptian god Ra, or Re, the sun god. That was a halo. That was considered a halo. The Romans had, if you read much Roman and Greek mythology, you know about the different, the Roman and Greek gods. Well, they had halos or crowns, or when they were represented, they were represented with this disc behind them. And the Roman emperors decided they wanted to be like God, so they made crowns for themselves that were like halos. And when they coined, when they made coins that represented whoever the Caesar was at the time, he always had a crown. But if you jump ahead to modern times, how many of you have seen Native American headdresses? That is a perfect example of a halo. And the more feathers, the more power, okay? And if you want to get a little, I guess I would say a little bit off the wall, but I can see this. Think of the aura that people talk about a lot. This is a picture of a woman with an aura. It's like a halo. And some people say people have auras just around their head that signify some kind of power or some essence of their nature, okay? Or around their whole body. And people can feel it and see it, and in different lights they see it. Well, take it for what you want, but auras are not that dissimilar from those halos. Don't think I'm crazy, please. And even though Scripture doesn't use the term halo or give any indication of halos around the heads of Mary or Jesus or anybody, nothing in Scripture talks about that, okay? Jesus wore a crown of thorns. Paul reminds us to run the race for the crown that's greater than the laurel wreath that the Olympic victors received, okay? And he also argued for the covering of head or the uncovering of the head in worship. In society and art, the head is the crown, okay? And other heads signify power and authority, head coverings of all different kinds. And art through the centuries portrays this. When I was a kid, my mom always wore a hat to church. Did yours? And for some, you know, for some groups, that's just very, very common. Well, moving on ahead, we all remember what Neil Armstrong said, or we've read what Neil Armstrong said when he landed on the moon, set foot on the moon, and he said, "This is one small step for man and one giant leap for mankind." So the period just before the Renaissance was a giant leap for mankind in regard to art. It's sometimes called the Gothic period or the Proto-Renaissance. We know Gothic and Proto-Renaissance art through big churches and big works of art that were inspired by and paid for by the church. Notre Dame, the Cologne Cathedral, Canterbury Cathedral in England, or Salisbury, York Minster, Westminster Abbey, those are those big places that were paid for and to show the power of the church, the beauty of the church, and those are all in the Gothic style. We also, Gothic art is also seen in illuminated manuscripts, huge murals on the walls of churches, overbearing sculptures. They're all examples of Gothic art. And most of this is religious because, you know, the ruling authorities paid for that. But art in the late medieval period really did undergo a major change, okay? It went away from the iconic images that we saw earlier to those realistic and natural portrayals of people. And let's look at the next slide. We've got two images here. The first is called the Stroganoff Madonna and Child. She was not making dinner. It's just called the Stroganoff Madonna and Child. What's different in this image? Who are they looking at? Yeah. Jesus is holding his hand up to Mary. This is what children do. We'll see this at the end of this presentation, too. And it's This is striking to me. This is the way children act toward their mothers. The other piece is, I included this. This is a Giotto. The Scrivini Chapel in Padua, Italy. It's 39 different panels, and it's done in temperas, which was a newer form of painting where you would draw a cartoon on a small part of the wall. You'd put fresh plaster in, quickly draw the cartoon, and then you'd apply egg or water tempera, and it would soak in. And so we have these many, many, many panels that could be done in one setting and wait until the plaster dried. You've seen images of the Sistine Chapel, or of the Sistine Chapel. The ceiling is the equivalent of 2.5 football fields. Would you want to lie on your back for 4.5 years and paint 2.5 football fields that were staring down at you? Well, that's what Michelangelo did. He didn't want to do it either. He complained every day about it, and he kept saying, "My aching back, and I'd rather be sculpting." But that's what that was. Similar to this, but he had a harder job of it. So those are two things that brought in the Renaissance. So we'll move to the next slide. The early Italian Renaissance. And in this one, it was mainly in Florence that this period of painting took place. It looks kind of, these paintings look kind of stilted, but they're far more natural looking than art previously to this. This piece is by Fra Angelico, and it's called The Annunciation. The angel is announcing the birth to Mary. It's still got halos, but look at what else is in here. She's in a room or in a courtyard area. You can see perspective here. Giotto was responsible for introducing one-point perspective so that all of a sudden you could see backgrounds. Eventually you'd see shading and shadowing, and this still looks very flat, but the one-point perspective is more clear. And then in this other piece, this is Masaccio. This actually shows that one-point perspective real clearly. We've got Mary and Joseph down below, and Jesus up above, and God the Father up at the top. So this is the Holy Family, okay? And you're involved in this painting because Mary's looking at you, and she's pointing to Jesus. So this, instead of keeping people off, away from things, it's inviting you into the painting. This was something really spectacular for the early Renaissance. In the next slide, we'll look at the Northern Renaissance paintings. The Dutch invented oil paints. Is that cool? It was so humid up in the north that they couldn't get the tempera paints to dry. So they messed around with oil and color and developed paints that they made new colors with oil paints that nobody had seen before. And this particular piece, the artist, this is Jan van Eck. He did layer upon layer upon layer in order to make shadows and create greater depth. I included this because I really like this painting. It looks like his wife is pregnant, but she's not. She's just holding her dress up. That was the way women walked around back then, I suppose. They like to hold their dress up and then they look pregnant, because I think at that time it was really important for you to be pregnant. Well, she just got married. This is their wedding picture, so she's not pregnant yet. But he's holding his hand up in blessing of their marriage. Her head is covered. His head is covered. No halos here. They're just regular people. They're not saints. But this is a symbol of God's power and authority on them, that they're wearing these head coverings. There's a bed right back here. And there's an image in the bed that you really can't see here. It's of St. Margaret, who's the patron saint of women being fertile. Okay. There's also a dog in this picture, which is a symbol. Let's see, the dog is the symbol of. Is it? What is the dog the symbol of? Of course. Thank you so much. There's also a single candle somewhere in this image that represents Christ. And then the guy in the mirror is Jan Van Eyck. He had to do a little self-portrait. And above, this is an early form of graffiti. It says, Jan Van Eyck was here. But it's not a religious picture. It's a picture of a family, like you or me. Yours or mine, okay? This is a family portrait. The Dutch really like to do family portraits, and they like to put in as many details in the background as possible. So they used a lot of symbols, but they also were very naturalistic. So we'll look at, in the next slide, we see a German artist who's also of the Northern Renaissance, Albert Dürer. Oops. This is very natural. This is Saint Anne and Mary and Jesus. And then we've got close-ups of them. This is what you can do with oil painting in the 1400s. I love this piece. He's one of my favorites, although he was an engraver, so he spent a lot more time with engraving than he did with painting. Can you hear me okay? Okay. And then we move on to the High Renaissance, which is the late 1400s, early 1500s. That was characterized by classical humanism. And so there was a real shift away from church art more into, well, whatever your concept of humanism is. It's not so much church art. Even though the art was paid for by the popes and it nearly bankrupt the city of Rome, it was still very humanistic in nature and very natural and of course very, very beautiful. The next image is of the Pietà, which we're all familiar with, and I only showed the top of it. You know, it was damaged some years ago. A crazy person came in and started hacking away at it. It's been repaired somewhat. But of when you're thinking about a mother and child, this to me is just one of the clearest, most beautiful representations of mother and child from the Renaissance. And then we'll move on to the next one, to Leonardo da Vinci, who is, I mean, talk about a Renaissance man. He probably coined the phrase, made the press to print the coin. Yeah, he did it all. He was actually too busy to keep at just one thing because he was doing so many things. He invented the first airplane on paper. Didn't fly it, but he was an architect, an engineer, a scientist. He did it all. You may know his Mona Lisa or the Vitruvian Man, you know, the circle with a guy like that. But he didn't do much portrait painting. But here we see three of his portraits that he actually finished. He would start things, and then he didn't finish them because he got bored, and he had another idea, so he'd go on to something else. But these are three good pieces. The third one is a little, you probably wonder why I put that in. That's called The Lady with an Ermine. The ermine is the little animal. But I put it in because of the face. And the first one is Mary and Saint Anne, and Jesus, and John. And it's just a beautiful sketch, and you can see these images, you can do Google images and find all of these, but this is, to me, one of the most beautiful ones. And then this one is a famous one called the Yarn Winder, and Jesus is holding a yarn winder, and if you know what a yarn winder is, when you would spin wool, you would have to wind it into skeins, and so he's holding the winder that after Mary spun the wool, she would put it into a skein. So he's holding that, but it's also a cross. So Mary is looking lovingly at her son while he is looking at the cross. And that just makes you think all sorts of things. So think those things. Then we'll move on to the next slide, and we see Raphael. Raphael started out in Florence, and the type of painting that he was taught in Florence was not like this. He took a lot of credit from Da Vinci. Da Vinci's soft shading, it's called chiaroscuro. I used to know Italian, I don't know it anymore, so I can't pronounce it worth anything. But you can see the depth in this first painting, the shadowing in this. That was particular to Raphael. And then the other one is called the Sistine Madonna. This is a very modern-looking painting of a mother and child, much different from those Byzantine icons. So you can see where things are going. The perspective is real clear in this and in his other work. The Renaissance painters made use of perspective more and more and more. If you've seen the School of Athens, that beautiful piece where the philosophers are on the steps, and it's all in one-point perspective. So is the Last Supper. By the way, in the Last Supper, you don't see any halos, but there's a In the image, you know, the big one of the Last Supper, you don't see any halos, even though you think, well, why did those people put halos at least on Jesus, you know? And they're all the disciples sitting there having dinner, but they didn't want to do halos anymore, and so instead they right behind Jesus you'll see a doorway like that, so that takes the place of the halo. And then I want to show you one final image that's from the late Renaissance. This is at the Art Institute in Chicago. And every time I go there, and I go there often, I have to hang out in front of this sculpture, and I just stare at it. I love this piece. It's 1686. The artist is Giuseppe Maria Crespi. And this is The Wedding at Cana. Now, back in Jesus' day, you think folks wore clothes like that? But this is 1686. So the artist used, for him, what would be modern dress. And what I like, well, I like a lot of things about this. But here's the wedding at Cana. So the wine steward has just shown up and has handed the wine to the master of ceremonies here. And the image, the expression on his face, he's just absolutely filled with wonder because he can't believe this is the good stuff. This is better than anything I've ever bought that we've made. Where did you find this? And, of course, Jesus and Mary, they're not saying anything because, you know, it's already happened. But Jesus is pointing down the way people point in blessing at two mongrel dogs. And I figure that's us. We're the mongrels at the group. But thank God for his blessings on us. And Mary, she's willing to go along with everything. We see her relationship to Jesus here in a different way. She's the maidservant of God. As she said, when the angel came to her to announce the birth, she said, "Who am I?" You know, and she maintained that. This is her relationship with God. She's bearer of the Messiah, and she's still full of wonder. You know, She said, Jesus, they have no wine. And he says, what does he say? Does he say anything? He says, have those water casks filled? And then nothing else has to be said. So I love, to me, this is a Madonna and Child picture as well. Well, now we're going to take another giant leap forward to the Impressionists. And we're doing this in part because I'm not as interested in art between the late Renaissance and the Impressionists as I probably should be, or as I will be a few years from now. So I don't know that much about it. So why talk about it? So, Claude Monet and Camille Pissarro. I love the Impressionists. I want to be an Impressionist, okay? I just love the style of the Impressionists. Camille Pissarro was about 10 years older than Claude Monet. And these aren't really strong images of them, but they are mothers and children. And the Impressionists wanted to portray to the world the natural life of the family. And now, I've hung clothes up when my kids were little, and they did not sit there quietly. But that's his impression of a nice day outside with the kids. And Claude Monet, the same thing. You just can't get much done when you've got children with you. But these are two good images of mothers and children. There were a number of Impressionists, and Renoir, you'll see in the next slide, was a kind of an Impressionist wannabe, but he moved away from the Impressionists because he decided that really wasn't for him. But go ahead and do the next slide, and we'll... There was a good Impressionist exhibit at the Art Institute recently, and this was one of those that was highlighted. And that one, this is my favorite of all Renoir's. It's called Two Sisters. But for me, it looks like my daughter Rachel and one of her children. So when Rachel and Christina came to the Art Institute with me, I have a nice picture of them standing in front of Renoir's Two Sisters, because that's them. But this is another piece of Renoir's. Now, this looks like a mother with two daughters, but this is her daughter, and unfortunately, this is her son. And I'll bet he asked his parents to put this in the back room because, you know, you get a certain age and you don't want to be known for wearing a dress. And it's intended to look very natural, and boys always wore dresses back then until they were old enough to know better. But it's intended to look very natural, but do you know any dog that would let a kid sit on him? So this was probably done real quickly, okay? Very, very, very quickly. But it's a beautiful painting, and it kind of idealizes motherhood. So when you think of the Impressionists, you can kind of go back to ideals again, almost iconic images of mothers and children. Then we have a few more coming up. Mary Cassatt. I think this is an idealistic image of a mother and child. Everyday life, everyday people. Her images are not images of royalty or power, but they're just, this is you or me. I would want to draw a picture of you and your child like this. Okay. But yet they represent symbols. Go ahead and we'll look at the next one. What does this make you think? That first photograph from the first slide, and I said, what does it make you think? When we get to the Impressionists, I always ask people, what does it make you think? What image does this bring up? This is a very... this is not a well-known picture of Mary Cassatt, hers, but who has not seen this in their own home? This just symbolizes to me absolute love of a mother, both images. And then the next one. just normal situations, mothers and children. I think that these are images that are would be on the walls of Plato, would be on the walls of Plato's cave. Okay, and every person sees them in different ways. I think there's one more of Mirakasan. Yes. Absolute love, absolute endearance and endurance with children who probably don't sleep at night, who are crying and they need comforting, but this is what mothers do. Okay. So when we move away from the Impressionists to modern and postmodern times, something that happened that wasn't common for the Impressionists, photography came in. Okay. It was just becoming an art form at the time, and Degas and some of the Impressionists would take pictures that they saw in magazines, and then they would actually copy them as artworks, as oils, which is pretty strange, because you think somebody drew this for a magazine that cost 10 cents, and then Degas goes along and does an oil painting of it, and it sells for lots of money. But people did that with photography. And if you do any artwork, you know, you take pictures, and then you use those pictures to help you see things the way you want to see them for the particular piece of art you're doing. But when I think of how photography changed the way people looked at things and how art was produced, that was a new technology. Just like the move from encaustic to temperate to oil painting, well, photography changed the way we look at art too. So let's look at this next image. And we've probably all seen this. This Dorothea Lange took this photograph. This woman has 7 children, taken around 1936 in California. She was a migrant worker, a pea picker. I think this is an iconic image of the Great Depression. And it's, I don't just think it, this is an iconic image of the Great Depression. It asks, just like the Byzantine icons, it asks people to reflect on the symbolism, on the deeper meaning, on the implications of homelessness and joblessness and hunger. If you said, what does this picture say? You could use those terms. This is despair, hunger. This is an iconic image. And even though Mirakasan and the other Impressionists had moved away from the formal to the more natural settings, I really see in this picture a symbol of that love between a mother and her children in the face of absolute despair. When I look at this, I look back at some of those Christian images of Mary and Joseph and Jesus going into Egypt. And I think, how did Mary look when they were on their way to Egypt? Running away. How did she look on the way back? How did she look on the way to Bethlehem before Jesus was born? She didn't know. Here's a mother who doesn't know what's going to happen tomorrow. How did Mary look at the crucifixion? I think one of the images we kind of skipped over was Jesus coming down, being taken off the cross, and Mary had fainted. And as Jesus is being lifted off the cross like this, she's being laid on the ground and her arms are spread out the same way as Jesus. So she was at one with her son in that despair, that feeling of despair at, here's my son who's died. This mother in this image doesn't know what the next day is going to bring. Well, there are a lot more images of that kind of despair that we see in newspapers and magazines. We see it online every day. And iconic images are an important part of our world nowadays when we've got a lot more of it hitting us than ever. But I'd like you to consider why artists represent mothers and children in their artwork. Whether it's in the iconic and symbolic images that we've seen, or like this, or whether it's just to express something beautiful, playful. On my way home from church today, we were going down Lincoln Way, and I saw a little kid in a snowsuit running, you know, like 2 years old, running like 2 year olds run, and his mother in front of him with a camera, and she's laughing and she's trying to take pictures of him, you know, in every move he makes because he's so cute and she just wants to remember this moment. And sometimes that's what art is. We just want that instant memory that makes us laugh and makes us happy. But let's look at the next slide. And as we look at these very modern images of mothers and children, we should remember the ideal that I think all of these images portray. Okay? Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Let the children come to me and forbid them not, for to such belong the kingdom of heaven. And God so loved the world that he sent his only Son. And of course, too greater love has no man than that he lay down his life for his brethren. Let's look at the last image, the last slide too. More? I mean more of that was, so we want to look at that one. So when we think about that those last pictures that are going to show up on the screen, they're good photos. I like those photos. Let's get down to the bottom. Can you just slide? Oh. In review, so sweet. There's some good ones there anyway, but you know, Jesus called us to go into the world, and these images are from all over the world, mothers and children. The very rocks will one day cry out to him, okay? And just as children cry out to us in the middle of the night. Until that day comes, we see through the images of the love between mother and child, the joy that is ours as we celebrate Emmanuel, the God who is with us. So in closing, I want to remind you of what God said to Moses. What do you have in your hand? Just as the mother guides the child and holds the child close to her heart and caresses the child in her hands, Jesus held his hand out to us in art and in life, a hand of blessing and a hand of forgiveness and a hand with the images of the cross on it. Okay, thank you. I would recommend that you go to the Art Institute every day of your life. You'll always find new things. And it's just, it has encouraged me to investigate art and learn so much more than I ever thought I could learn. And that's just from one place, one Art Institute. I'll never get to the Louvre. But you know, who does she come? The Brower Museum at the University. And to try it yourself, because after I started going to the Art Institute and started studying, I actually started drawing, and I liked it. It's fun. And it's something that I have in my hand, and God can use it for good. He might laugh at it sometimes. Are you kidding? But, you know, you can, whatever you have in your hand, God can make great use.
Okay, well, thank you again, Nancy, for that, and the examples. We should really appreciate that. So, yeah, I invite you to